scientists point out that forcing Israel to withdraw from Islamic Holy Land is not an Arab cause, but in fact it is a greater cause of Muslim nationalism beyond color, creed, and geography, something which overwhelmingly prevails in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
In a rare case, the second in Yemen in the past 3 years, a pair of conjoined twins were born in a Sabain hospital in Yemeni capital Sana'a. The two children are in critical condition and need to be treated outside the country, which is impossible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a airport to the Yemenis.
This is a tragedy that children in Yemen suffer as a result of aggression, blockade, and the use of internationally prohibited weapons as well as malnutrition. In the case of the Siamese twins and congenital deformations, the biggest problem is that we cannot send them abroad to have surgery, so their lives are at risk.
The director of the Health Bureau called on the United Nations and the World Health Organization to send a plane to transport the two children or to send a medical team to conduct the surgery inside Yemen, where devastated and under-resourced health services cannot offer any help to these children.
I'm the father of the twins, and their condition is critical, and they need to receive medical care and surgery outside the country because the health situation in Yemen is collapsing and Sana'a airport is still closed.
Infants suffer a difficult situation in Yemen, and the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemen health services have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on the country in 2015.
With the fast approaching of the new year, the Sana'a airport remains closed to sick children and women, causing the loss of many lives. The airport is open to United Nations airplanes only. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Local elections in Indian-administered Kashmir held in 8 phases have come to an end. The voting process has remained by and large peaceful amid stringent security measures. After the revocation of Kashmir's special status, regional political parties had refused to participate in the electoral process as a sign of protest against India's decision to strip Kashmir of its autonomous status. That resulted in the strengthening of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in the Muslim majority region. However, this time, the regional parties formed an alliance to take part in the local elections. Compared to the past, a large number of people came forth to cast their ballots, and many of them told Press TV that their aim is to keep the BJP away from Kashmir's grassroots.
Since the BJP came to power in India, it started taking decisions against minorities. The BJP has taken Kashmir's autonomy, Kashmiris' jobs, and now they are eyeing land. They don't care about the people of Kashmir. We came to cast our votes against those people who only aim to destroy Kashmir's ethnicity in the name of mainstreaming Kashmir.
More and more people in Kashmir have developed skepticism on the overall electoral process after scores of video interviews of the District Development Council or DDC candidates started circulating on social media. A number of candidates have no idea what positions they are running for in the local administration, and even worse, some have no idea what DDC means.
Kashmir, man. In order for votes to be equally distributed, the Election Commission has accepted nominations from all sorts of people. There is no set prerequisite for candidates. I wonder who they are empowering. How can an uneducated person with no idea of economy, finance and politics seek equal rights and development for me? Basically, they do not need educated people. They want stooges who will implement what the Indian government will decide for us, without thinking about people's interests.
This is the first time that DDC elections are being held. Members of the DDC are expected to prepare and approve district plans and expenditure schemes, which will replace the district planning and development boards in all districts across the region. Earlier, district development boards looked after the planning, approval, or implementation of centrally sponsored schemes. The result of the eight-phase elections will be announced on December 22nd. Apparently, the elections in Kashmir have paved the way for other electoral processes in the volatile region. However, many say this ballot has made the people of Kashmir politically aware of the fact that New Delhi is trying to thrust such electoral processes in order to create an impression that normalcy has taken hold after it stripped Kashmir of its autonomy, actually without building trust and bridging the gaps. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The COVID-19 pandemic has accentuated and in fact accelerated the sharp inequalities that exist in every society individually and the world at large. According to a June 2020 study conducted in the United States by the Brookings Institute, the number of deaths as a result of the disease reflects a clear racial logic. Many indicators included in the study leave no doubt that racism is a central factor in the life cycle of COVID. For example, among those aged between 45 and 54 years, Black and Hispanic Latino death rates are at least 6 times higher than for whites. Although whites make up 62% of the U.S. population of that specific age group, only 20% of the total deaths were white. Black and Latino communities were the most devastated. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Ramzi Barud Ryder. This article is published under the heading, The Great Divider. COVID-19 reflects global racism, not equality. Here's the details of this article. The notion that the COVID-19 pandemic was the great equalizer should be dead and buried by now. If anything, the lethal disease is another terrible reminder of the deep divisions and inequalities in societies. That said, the treatment of the disease should not be a repeat of the same shameful scenario. For an entire year, wealthy celebrities and government officials have been reminding people that we are in this together and we are on the same boat. Such statements have generated much media attention, not just because they are both famous people with a massive social media following, but also because of the obvious hypocrisy in their empty rhetoric. In truth, however, they were only repeating the standard procedure followed by governments, celebrities, and wealthy influencers worldwide. With unemployment rates skyrocketing across the US and the globe, hundreds of millions scraping by to feed their children, multitudes of nameless and hapless families chugging along without access to proper health care, subsisting on hope and a prayer so that they may survive the scourges of poverty, let alone the pandemic, one cannot, with a clear conscience, make such outrageous claims. According to World Bank data, nearly half of the world lives on less than $5.5 a day. This dismal statistic is part of a remarkable trajectory of inequality that has afflicted humanity for a long time. The plight of many of the world's poor is compounded in the case of war refugees, the double victims of state terrorism and violence, and the unwillingness of those with the resources to step forward and pay back some of their largely undeserved wealth. The boat metaphor is particularly interesting in the case of refugees. Millions of them have desperately tried to escape the infernos of war and poverty in rickety boats and dinghies, hoping to get across from their stricken regions to safer places. This sight has sadly grown familiar in recent years, not only throughout the Mediterranean Sea, but also in the other bodies of water around the world, especially in Burma, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have tried to escape their ongoing genocide. Thousands of them have drowned in Bay of Bengal. The COVID-19 pandemic has accentuated and, in fact, accelerated the sharp inequalities that exist in every society individually and the world at large. According to a June 2020 study conducted in the United States by the Brookings Institute, the number of deaths as a result of the disease reflects a clear racial logic. Many indicators included in the study leave no doubt that racism is a central factor in the life cycle of COVID. For example, among those aged between 45 and 54 years, Black and Hispanic Latino death rates are at least six times higher than for whites, although whites make up 62% of the U.S. population of that specific age group. Only 22% of the total deaths were white. Black and Latino communities were the most devastated. According to this and other studies, the main assumption behind the discrepancy of infection and death rates resulting from COVID among various racial groups in the U.S. is poverty, which is itself an expression of racial inequality. The poor have no or limited access to proper health care. For the rich, this factor is of little relevance. Moreover, poor communities tend to work in low-paying jobs in the service sector, where social distancing is nearly impossible. With little government support to help them survive the lockdowns, they do everything within their power to provide for their children, only to be infected by the virus or, worse, die. This inequality is expected to continue even in the way that the vaccines are made available. While several Western nations have either launched or scheduled their vaccination campaigns, the poorest nations on Earth are expected to wait for a long time before life-saving vaccines are made available. In 67 poor or developing countries located mostly in Africa and the Southern Hemisphere, only 1 out of 10 individuals will likely receive the vaccine by the end of 2020, the Fortune magazine website reported. The disturbing report cited a study conducted by a humanitarian and rights coalition, the People's Vaccine Alliance, PVA, which includes Oxfam and Amnesty International. If there is such a thing as a strategy at this point, it is the deplorable hoarding of the vaccine by rich nations. Dr. Moga Kamalyani of PVA put this realization into perspective when she said that rich countries have enough doses to vaccinate everyone nearly 3 times over, while poor countries don't even have enough to reach health workers and people at risk. So much for the numerous conferences touting the need for a global response to the disease. But it does not have to be this way. While it is likely that class, race, and gender inequalities will continue to ravage human societies after the pandemic, as they did before, it is also possible for governments to use this collective tragedy as an opportunity to bridge the inequality gap, even if just a little, as a starting point to imagine a more equitable future for all of us. Poor, darker-skinned people should not be made to die when their lives can be saved by a simple vaccine, which is available in abundance.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. In a virtual meeting on Monday, top diplomats of Iran, Germany, France, the UK, China, and Russia renewed commitment to preserving the Iran nuclear deal. They also want Washington to return to the deal with no preconditions. Foreign Minister Zarif says that Britain, France, and Germany share the blame with the U.S. for irreparable harms to Iranians. At the same time, Iranian MPs want the Rouhani administration to install cascades of advanced centrifuges and raise uranium enrichment. They have given a 2-month ultimatum for Tehran to start enjoying economic benefits under the nuclear accord. That's what we'll be discussing in this debate show.
Foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and world powers have reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. During a virtual meeting, China and Russia called on the United States to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Tehran.
The United States should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally as soon as possible. It should also lift the sanctions against Iran, third-party entities, as well as individuals. And on this basis, Iran should fully resume its nuclear commitments.
Following the meeting, Iran's foreign minister said the Iran-EU declining trade data from 2014 to 2019 proved that the European signatories to the nuclear deal have gravely breached their commitments under the accord. Mohammad Javad Zarif said Britain, France and Germany should share the blame with the U.S. for what he called irreparable harm to Iranians. He said the trio has a last chance to save the pact. This comes about a month after the Iranian parliament gave a two-month chance to the West to lift the sanctions on Iran by overwhelmingly voting yes to a draft bill dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to lift sanctions. It requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. The plan, among other things, requires the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to produce and stockpile at least 120 kilograms of enriched uranium with a 20% purity level annually within 2 months after the adoption of the law. The parliament adopted the measure in the wake of the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which Iran blames on Israel. Ironically, Europeans once again failed to condemn the targeted killing of yet another Iranian scientist. In recent weeks, Europeans were found expressing hopes for a possible return of the U.S. to the JCPOA as President-elect Joe Biden is preparing to take office next month. However, their stance remains dubious with regard to the Iran deal, as they are now talking about revitalizing the accord if Iran negotiates on its missile program. However, Iran has stressed that it will not accept any preconditions in returning to the nuclear deal and will not negotiate its missile program or regional activities. Tehran says the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed and is coming to an end.
Well, that was Mehdi Farahmand reporting. Now, joining me in this debate will be Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, out of Budapest, and also Director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Tarabi from the Iranian city of Qom. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Budapest. George, Iran's top diplomat blames the European signatories of the JCPOA for little trade ties with Europe. The financial mechanism that they launched, known as ZANSTEX, has not done much to facilitate trade and banking transactions as it was supposed to do. What's the EU side of the nuclear deal going to do this time?
Well, the Iranians are for the Iranians, because when the JCPOA was signed, it was always seen that at some point the United States would walk away. And so Iran was given assurances that should the United States walk away, should the United States impose sanctions, the Europeans, European signatories to the JCPOA, would make up for it. It would actually give us, in other words, Iran wouldn't lose anything as a result of the United States withdrawal from the JCPOA. Well, that never materialized. Trade between the Europeans and Iran is now lower than it was before the JCPOA was signed. So the Iranians are understandably very frustrated about this, and they are obviously rather annoyed with all this high-handed talk. The United States will return to the JCPOA if Iran does this, 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 and this, and this. Well, Iran wasn't the one who walked away from the agreement. Iran wasn't the one who violated the agreement. So why should Iran undertake to do things that it was never supposed to undertake in accordance with the JCPOA to which Iran had adhered?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Now, Sam, the remaining parties to the nuclear deal are asking Washington to go back to the JCPOA, from which President Trump pulled his country out unilaterally, and that, of course, without any preconditions. Now, what do you expect Joe Biden to do?
Well, actually, I have to say that what we heard today from Dr. Zarif was a very clear statement of Iran's position. It's a continuation of what Dr. Zarif spoke about when he was in the Euromed discussions. And it's very clear, and he also tweeted it, where this is the last chance for the Europeans and for the U.S. to do whatever they need to do for the JCPOA. And, you know, last chance means last chance, inshallah, hopefully. Because basically what we saw, especially in Dr. Zarif's tweet, he laid out the points that in detail, which I'm not going to repeat here because of time. But basically, he made a very important point. He said to the Europeans that democracies, and he put the word democracies in quotation marks, cannot ask Iran not to implement the law of the parliament that the parliament has passed. So basically, this last chance is going to be less than 2 months that the Europeans and the Americans have. In less than 2 months, the government will implement a new law. Dr. Zarif said the same thing in the Euromed conference. And so this is what's in front of us now. And the question is, and it's not even a question, I think, it's maybe a rhetorical question, is who really believes that the Americans and the Europeans are going to do in 2 months what they haven't done in, you know, a number of years? So this is the reality. The reality is that the Americans and the Europeans will not do what they were supposed to do all these years in these 2 months. As Dr. Zarif stated in his tweet, the Iranian people must, and he capitalized must, feel that there is a sanctions relief and that the sanctions are lifted. This clearly will not happen in the next 2 months. And in 2 months, the law that was passed by the parliament will be implemented. And it could be that we live in a world where Iran never leaves the JCPOA technically, but practically there is no such thing as the JCPOA.
It's less than 2 months, and only 1 month left. Yeah, Georgia, Tehran has negated renegotiating the nuclear deal on grounds that there has been no give and take, and that's the natural outcome of any deal. And Iran did comply to the letter, as you know, of the agreement, but did not benefit economically as it was supposed to under the accord. Now, what can be done to avoid the repeat of such an action on the part of the EU?
Well, I mean, obviously, what could be done is the United States returning to the JCPOA unconditionally and lifting sanctions unconditionally. Whether that will happen is, of course, extremely doubtful. But it's very hard to see why Iran would want to start complying with all sorts of requirements that were no part of the JCPOA when the states that are demanding this of Iran have themselves not adhered to the JCPOA. So the United States obviously hasn't adhered to it by walking out unilaterally. The Europeans haven't adhered to it by not compensating Iran for the economic hardships it suffered as a result of the United States withdrawal. So the Europeans and the Americans are not in compliance, and now they're demanding that Iran start adhering to all sorts of conditions that were no part of the JCPOA, and which incidentally are unreasonable demands, because of course Iran does need ballistic missiles. I mean, Iran requires them for its security. I mean, Iran has been threatened by the United States. It has been attacked by the United States. It has been repeatedly threatened by Israel. Iran should have the means of defending itself. And the same goes for its being a regional power. I mean, it clearly has an interest in ensuring the security of Syria and Lebanon. Iran cannot just give up on these things. So these requests are absurd, and Iran will rightly reject them.
Now, Sam, the incoming U.S. president has promised to take his country back to the nuclear deal and also lift the sanctions, while also hinting at more negotiations on Iran's missile program and what it calls regional influence. Now, Tehran has asserted time and again it does not intend to negotiate its missile program. It serves as a deterrent. And also, for your information, we just had this news that Israel's Western-supplied submarines just passed the Suez Canal. It's heading toward the Persian Gulf. So why should Iran in such condition, you know, compromise its defensive capabilities while it's facing military threats from Israel and the U.S.?
Well, clearly it's not going to do it, just as my colleague said. The point is this. Iran, through its foreign minister, in an official meeting at ministerial level, has declared and told the other participants, the Europeans and the Americans, that this is their last chance. So the question is, will Dr. Zarif and the current administration in Iran have the courage to end this game, this so-called process, when this last chance is missed by the Americans and the Europeans, which it will be missed? There might be some cosmetic things that are done, there might be some statements, but none of the things that Iran has been demanding for years is going to be implemented by any of the other parties in the next 2 to 3 months. So this is the question. Will the JCPOA effectively end in the government that signed it, in the administration that signed it, or will this administration just simply wait until its term is over and we have a new government, a new administration in Iran in June, and this will go down in history as one of the many failures of this administration, many of the unkept promises that this administration had. The issue is not to beat on this administration, to beat up on this administration. The point is that many things were said 8 years ago by the president and by the foreign minister, and none of them happened. So this is something that we have to learn from. There was a decision by the Iranian state to enter into a strategic negotiation with the West. It actually started 20 years ago with the goal of normalizing economic relations with the West. The result after 20 years is that this didn't happen. And a big reason for that is that the people in Iran pursuing this path did not have a clear understanding of the reality of what the U.S. is, and a clear understanding that the Europeans are basically vassals of the United States. They do not have the power to defend their own interests. It is in Germany's and Europe's interest to have independent economic and strategic relations with Iran, but they are not capable of doing that. And this is a deep issue, this is a deep civilizational and historical issue of the Europeans post-World War II. So, we have a generation in Iran who grew up at a time where the only alternative in the world was the West. This is, if you look back, late 80s, early 90s, this whole way of thinking started at that time in Iran. The world of 2020 is very different than the world of 1989 or 1991. There are alternatives for Iran besides the West. And what's very interesting, and something that's very rarely reported, is that the one group in Iran which has always been a champion for relations with the West, which is those who are involved in business in the industrial field, not consumer products, industrial products, who maybe for generations, one, two, three generations, have had relations with the West, they themselves have given up on the West, and especially on Europe, when they saw how the Europeans were not able to defend economic interests that they had established over decades. So the Iranians, the elites in Iran, have now come to the point where they have alternatives to the West, which they didn't have 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. They entered this process, and history has recorded that this process has failed for Iran. That the Westerners bring in countries into processes, the peace process with the Palestinians, the whatever process you want to call this that we had with the West, this is nothing new. But process in itself has no benefit or profit for Iran. The goal of all this was to lift sanctions and to normalize economic relations. Mm-hmm. It hasn't happened, and it won't happen.
Okay, George, as Sam also mentioned in his comments a few minutes ago, recently the Iranian legislators have passed this bill that pushes the Rouhani administration to further enrich uranium and make use of more advanced centrifuges, etc. Now, they insist that they want an end to what they call the one-sided gain to which Iran adhered even more than 2 years after Washington left it without benefiting much from it. Let's have your comments on this.
Well, it's very understandable that the parliament has insisted on this, and I think it's that it's a right course for Iran to take. Iran is a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It is entitled to all of the benefits of a peaceful use of nuclear energy. Iran does not, never has had a nuclear weapons program. Has no interest in nuclear weapons, and it gave up. Unilaterally gave up its nuclear energy program in return for commercial, economic, financial relations with the West. And as my colleague has pointed out, that never materialized. Well, since it never materialized, then Iran obviously has to pursue a different course. I think it should basically accept the JCPOA is no more, it's just history, and move along a different path. And it is entitled to the peaceful use of nuclear energy, and it does have economic partners that it can get around the However, whatever the hardships, I mean, there's no question. I mean, the given the power of the dollar, the U.S. sanctions have hurt Iran, very seriously hurt Iran. But Iran does have other options. It has partners in Russia and China, both of whom have an interest in essentially moving away from this unipolar world order where the United States basically dominated militarily and financially and economically, and therefore they have an interest in helping Iran out. So I think, I think that it's understandable that the Iranian parliament has decided that a different course would yield much better results than that they had embarked on 20 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Now, some Tehran argues that West Asia's crises and arms are mainly imported from the U.S., U.K., France, and Germany, and these countries are selling billions of, tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons to their allies in this region annually, and they are expecting Iran to curtail its defense capabilities. How can they?
I think Dr. Zarif said it best when he told the German foreign minister to shut up. It's Dr. Zarif said. Basically, you know, it's the height of hypocrisy, and I think it doesn't even require us to discuss this very deeply, the total moral depravity of the West when it talks about these things. If you look at Yemen, if you look at all the decades that these issues that exist with the Palestinians, and all the wars that we all of us experienced in this region because of what they did. And so, as was mentioned by my colleague, obviously Iran has a strategic deterrence, and it has now moving from a regional strategic deterrence to a global strategic deterrence. Again, these issues are often not mentioned in Western media, but Iran has officially declared that it has ICBM capability. So we're going to be in a world in a very short time, where Iran has strategic deterrence on a global level, where the Americans and the Europeans have to deal with an Iran that cannot be threatened with all options at the table, because if one of the options is used, then the option for Iran will be to retaliate in kind.
Okay.
And this is the big lesson that we have to learn, which is if you're going to enter into strategic negotiations with the West, you have to have strategic deterrence, which means missiles and submarines, because you mentioned submarines, and other military hardware that is able to create strategic deterrence.
Okay, appreciate your comments and contribution. We had a senior research fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, out of Budapest, and director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Tarabi from Qom.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, frauds and cheaters. Muslim society is based on purity of feeling, love, sincerity towards every Muslim, and fulfillment of promises to every member of society. Its members are endowed with piety, truthfulness, and faithfulness. Cheating and deception are alien characters in contrast to the noble character of a true Muslim. There is no room in it for swindlers, double-crossers, trickers, and, you know, traitors, for instance. Islam views cheating and deception as heinous sins, a source of shame to the one guilty of committing them, both in this world and the next. The Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, may the mercy and blessings of Allah be upon our beloved Prophet, did not merely denounce them by excluding them from the Muslim community in this world. He also announced that on the day of judgment, every traitor would be raised carrying the flag of his betrayal. And you know that on the day of judgment, there will be some people who will be humiliated, who will be insulted, and who will be disgusted. But they wouldn't have a choice at that point, because that's not where you rectify your actions. You have a chance and you have the opportunity to rectify your actions in this world. If one fails to do that, then on the day of judgment, only the rules of Allah are going to prevail. And based on those rules, this person will be humiliated and disgusted and insulted in front of everyone. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing frauds and cheaters. The shame of traitors, men and women, will be immense on the day of judgment. Those who thought that their betrayal had been forgotten will find it right there, exposed for the whole world to see on the banners raised high, held by their own hands. Just imagine the day of judgment. Who would like to be embarrassed there in front of everyone? There will be no veil. There will be no hiding of it. It's not an option. It's not possible. So somebody who was a cheat in this world, who was deceiving others in this world, it is very much possible that this person gets off the hook in this world. Nobody notices it. You know, he played it really smart and, you know, he just was not caught. But on the day of judgment, the scenario is going to be different. The scenery is going to be different. This person will be exposed right in front of every single individual. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said that God said, "There are three whom I oppose on the day of resurrection: a man who gave his word and then betrayed it, a man who sold a free man into slavery and kept the money, and a man who hired someone, benefited from his labor, then did not pay his wages." These are the three types that the Prophet said he is going to oppose, actively oppose, on the day of resurrection and on the day of judgment. So let's pray to Allah that we are not in one of these three categories. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
the limelight.
When U.S. President Donald Trump departs the White House next month, he will leave in his wake a nation devastated by a pandemic he failed to confront, and an economic scene characterized by rising poverty, widespread hunger, a looming eviction tsunami, and mass layoffs that have left the U.S. with fewer jobs than when his administration began. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading Fewer Jobs and Rising Poverty. Scathing report finds Trump's economic legacy one of the worst among all U.S. presidents. Stay tuned, please, for the details. When U.S. President Donald Trump departs the White House next month, he will leave in his wake a nation devastated by a pandemic he failed to confront, and an economic scene characterized by rising poverty, widespread hunger, a looming eviction tsunami, and mass layoffs that have left the U.S. with fewer jobs than when his administration began. And for that, a scathing new report by Democrats on the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, JEC, argues the outgoing president only has himself to blame. Released on Friday, December 18th, in response to the 2020 economic report of the president, the assessment of the Trump's economic performance during his 4 years in office runs directly counter to the rosy depiction frequently offered by the president himself, who seldom missed an opportunity to boast about the state of the stock market even in the midst of nationwide material suffering brought on by the coronavirus pandemic. American businesses and workers are struggling to survive because President Trump refused to listen to advice from public health experts and economists about the best way to handle the coronavirus. Representative Don Beyer, the incoming JEC chair, said in a statement, "In fact, his handling of the coronavirus will hurt the economy for years to come. That is President Trump's economic legacy, one of the worst among all U.S. presidents." The new report examines Trump's economic record dating back to the beginning of his administration, which began with soaring promises on jobs, trade, wages, health care, and other key policy matters. While Trump inherited a steadily improving economy, the president failed to pursue policies that would sustain and strengthen the economic expansion, the JEC report argues. As many analysts predicted before its passage and implementation, the $1.5 trillion tax cuts and jobs that Trump signed into law in December of 2017 delivered most of its benefits to the rich and failed to produce anything resembling an economic boom. President Trump's televised claim that the tax cuts would be one of the great Christmas gifts to the middle-income people proved to be deeply misleading, the JEC report notes. Analysis reveals that the tax cuts heavily favored the very wealthy, with the top 1% of households, those with average incomes of almost $2 million, projected to receive an average tax break of nearly $50,000 in 2020. This is approximately 64 times the average tax cut of the middle 20% of households, who were projected to receive an average tax cut of $780, the report continues. The poorest 20% were projected to receive an average tax cut of just $60. Trump's trade promises were similarly empty, the report finds. The presence of touted trade war with China resulted in hundreds of thousands of lost U.S. jobs. A study by Moody's Analytics found that by September 2019, it had cost the U.S. economy nearly 300,000 jobs, the JEC notes. While the president's economic performance prior to the coronavirus pandemic was far from successful, Trump's handling of the COVID-19 crisis and resulting economic collapse was catastrophic, pushing millions more into poverty and leaving countless Americans unable to afford basic necessities. At present, the U.S. has around 10 million fewer jobs than it did at the start of the pandemic. The JEC observes that after Congress and the White House approved the $2.2 trillion CARES Act in March, providing a temporary $600 per week boost to unemployment benefits and a round of one-time stimulus payments to many Americans, the administration and Senate Republicans refused to work to negotiate another package until a few weeks before the expiration of the unemployment supplement, a lapse that dramatically slashed the incomes of millions of people in the U.S. The administration's mismanagement of the coronavirus and its grudging response to limit the resulting economic damage have exposed and widened vast structural inequalities, the report states. Low-income workers and people of color have been most harmed by COVID-19 and the ensuing recession. They are more likely to be exposed to the virus, to be hospitalized, and to die from it. The JEC Democrats conclude that by all objective measures, job growth, unemployment, gross domestic product, Trump leaves the economy in much worse condition than he found it. However, the numbers do not tell the whole story. His failure to use the power of the presidency to fight the coronavirus will weigh down the U.S. economy for years to come, the report says. His successor